8 Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll talk to the chair of a new state assembly task force on urban education.
First, it appears that Wisconsin's two largest cities are of two minds in the debate over whether police officers should be required to wear body cameras. Yesterday, a Madison advisory committee voted against a pilot program that would test those cameras out next year.
On the other side of the issue, last Sunday, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett announced a proposal to equip all Milwaukee beat cops with body cameras by the end of 2016, a proposal supported by Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn. More than 2,000 in Milwaukee signed a petition urging the use of the cameras last year.
The no vote yesterday in Madison was made by an advisory committee. It doesn't rule out the possibility of that pilot program happening next year. Some of the concerns that the committee cited after talking to community members include privacy, a fear that officers could manipulate footage, and concern that it wouldn't address larger issues of trust.
Cami Chavis-Simmons joins us now to talk about the police body camera debate. She's the director of the Criminal Justice Program and professor of law at Wake Forest University. She's also a former prosecutor. Cami, welcome back to Central Time.
Yes, thank you for having me.
So how common is this debate over police body cameras right now around the country?
You know, I think it's interesting. I think that you see the differences between the two cities is really reflective of the discourse that's happening across the country. Body cameras are not necessarily a new technology, but I think that given the recent events of the past year, with certainly with Ferguson and Staten Island and Freddie Gray, many of these some of these instances having been videotaped, it's really catapulted the issue to the forefront. And the federal government pledging millions of dollars to help local communities equip themselves with body cameras. But I think what it shows us is that this is it's a very complex issue. Of course, there are the accountability concerns if we can have these instances on videotape, if officers know that their actions are going to be perhaps videotaped, then maybe they'll modify their behavior. That's the rationale. The same thing goes for citizens. Perhaps citizens will rectify or modify their conduct if they know that they're being taped. But at the same time, they're very serious privacy concerns that have to be considered as well.
Well, in terms of the general trend, are cities and governments and communities moving toward adopting body cameras, or are they moving more slowly with more caution?
You know, I think in the beginning, I would say about a year ago, we have now passed the anniversary of Michael Brown's shooting in Ferguson. And initially, there was a huge outcry to say, look, if this had been on videotape, we would not necessarily have the officer's word against the other witnesses. We'd have an objective accounting, an objective video of what happened. The problem with that is that there have also been other instances of alleged police misconduct that have been on videotape, and still the officers have been cleared there. So I think that kind of captures a little bit of the complexity, but I think that communities, I wouldn't say that it was a knee-jerk reaction. It makes sense to perhaps implement body cameras. And there's studies that show when officers, these studies are limited, but there's studies that show when officers are wearing cameras, complaints against police officers and rates of excessive uses of force decrease. However, I think that if anyone who's been involved in drafting one of these policies, the issues are complex, because we also have to take into account that officers, when they're responding to a call, may go into someone's home, and there are lots of privacy concerns related to wearing the cameras. I think also some communities are concerned about, particularly communities of color, being under an extreme amount of surveillance already, and that these cameras might just be adding to that.
We're talking with Cami Chavis-Simmons right now, director of the Criminal Justice Program and professor of law at Wake Forest University. We're talking about the advisory council here in Madison voting not to implement a pilot program to use police body cameras in the next year. And Milwaukee, on the other hand, the mayor introducing a budgetary item for those cameras to be implemented by the year 2016. So here in Madison, one of the things that was put forward by the council was that a concern, the body cameras would be construed as a quick fix, a Band-Aid approach, instead of fixing some of those deep underlying problems of mistrust between police and minority communities. What do you make about that decision on those grounds?
Well, I think it's interesting. I think that it's correct to assert that it shouldn't be a Band-Aid, and having even the widespread use of body cameras is not going to fix everything that needs to happen within police departments regarding greater accountability. However, I do think what that means, I think, is that body cameras need to be part of an overall comprehensive approach when we're thinking about criminal justice reform and reforming some of the law enforcement agencies. Body cameras can be an incredible tool just in terms of, again, of police accountability, but at the same time, there has to be a balance in the approach using those cameras. And I think I'd also say that the cameras have to be part of a wider, comprehensive model of reform. If you have an officer that repeatedly there's footage on the camera that demonstrates some unprofessional conduct, if that officer is not disciplined or is not held accountable, then there's not going to be any increase in trust. So it can be, I think body cameras can be part of an overall comprehensive plan.
Is there any consensus right now as to whether concerns like privacy that you mentioned and taking time to fix things at a more root level, whether those concerns outweigh some of the benefits you talked about?
I think that the consensus among a lot of people is it's important to have a pilot program first, right, so that we can determine the potential effect that these cameras might have and work out any bugs in terms of implementing the cameras department-wide. So I think you'd certainly want to start with having a pilot program rather than rolling the cameras out to all of the officers. But I think we also have to understand that this is an evolving issue, and the technology with regard to body cameras are going to evolve as well. I know that sometimes there are concerns that an officer may have access to the footage and could alter the footage, but the technology is such and is evolving as such to make that very difficult or impossible in some cases. And the officer's decision as to when to turn on the camera, when to activate the camera, the technology is evolving there. It right now seems to be in the officer's discretion if that's how a department policy dictates it. The officer has discretion in certain circumstances to turn it on. But you can draft policies that are very clear that indicate when an officer should have their camera on and under what circumstances the officer would be using the camera.
And can we just very briefly, as we wrap up here, if Milwaukee does implement this move to implement body cameras by 2016, what kind of challenges do you think that they should be aware of going forward?
I think the challenges, the privacy concerns are real, and having very clear standards as to how the data is going to be stored, how long it's going to be stored, who has access to the data, is the general public going to be able to access this data under the Freedom of Information Act? There are lots of different concerns that many communities are dealing with now.
Cami, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Cami Chavis-Simmons, director of the Criminal Justice Program and professor of law at Wake Forest University. Yesterday, a Madison advisory committee voted against implementing a body camera pilot program. That comes after Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett announced Sunday a plan to equip all Milwaukee B-cops with cameras by the end of 2016.
Coming up, we'll talk to the chair of the newly created Bipartisan Assembly Task Force on Urban Education here in Wisconsin, hear about some of the challenges facing school districts in Milwaukee and Wisconsin's biggest cities.
First, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss created a special task force last month to focus on the unique challenges that urban schools face. As students around the state head back to school, the chair of that task force joins us for a look at the challenges facing districts in Wisconsin's biggest cities.
Republican Representative Jesse Rodriguez of Franklin is the Majority Caucus Secretary in the State Assembly. She's the newly appointed chair of the Speaker's Task Force on Urban Education. Representative Rodriguez, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Rob, for having me.
Well, first of all, big picture, why does Wisconsin need this urban education task force?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I am very honored and very excited about the urban task force on the task force on urban education. It is an area that we certainly need to look at. We are, as a task force, it is a bipartisan task force. Who will look at a variety of topics that affect the urban schools. And our ultimate goal is to provide solutions and hopefully help improve outcomes in the urban schools. So we will be looking at six school districts, and they are Milwaukee, Madison, Kenosha, Green Bay, Racine, and Eau Claire. And these six districts make up about 20% of the total student population and also our future workforce. They are also, in these districts, about 50% of the student population receive free and reduced school meals. So it is a community that is very economically disadvantaged. And also these districts have higher than average special needs services and unfortunately low student achievement. So it's an area that we certainly need to look at and offer solutions to improve those outcomes in these districts.
And as you look at these districts, what kind of issues are you going to focus on the task force?
Sure. So we, talking with the superintendents, and that's been one of my goals, is to talk to each one of them before we go to the districts and do tours of the schools, is really hear what they're seeing. I mean, they are the experts of their districts. And so some of the things that keep popping up from conversations has been teacher recruitment and retention. That's a difficulty for many of the districts. They are seeing that, from what I hear, that many teachers, you know, are there who come, you know, recently graduated, you know, have the skills and the education. It's just that many of them don't have the support system to handle the issues that they see presented in the class, such as truancy, such as behavioral issues. And so those are the things that we need to really look at and see what ways we can improve that. There's also, like I said, behavioral issues that we should look at, below average academic performance. And so this is an opportunity for us to see what the districts are seeing are happening within their schools, but also for them to be able to let us know what they have done, what has worked, what hasn't worked, and ways that, you know, we can improve the outcomes in these districts.
So a new report on the teacher workforce in Milwaukee in particular found that teachers now are less educated, less experienced than they have been in the past, about 5-6 years ago. What do you see the task force being able to do to recommend to help attract teachers and, as you say, retain them in a place like Milwaukee?
Sure. You know, I think that is the conversation we're trying to have with the district. And so they, like I said, many of them are saying, you know, these teachers are equipped. They have the right credentials. They just don't know how to handle the situations that they see in the district, in the classroom. And so it's an opportunity for them to offer other ways, other support systems to help these teachers. So you know, that is kind of going to be the focus of the recruitment and retention piece of the urban schools. I do hear many superintendents say that, you know, a lot of the teachers come to our school, stay about 3 years, and eventually they move on to other districts in the suburbs. And so that is, you know, unfortunately, where these teachers are needed, which is in the urban setting. Unfortunately, they're not able to retain them. And so that is, you know, a way that we can look at and see if something more needs to be done, and what can we possibly do.
Now, Wisconsin, of course, has a lot of rural school districts, suburban ones as well. Do you think we need to avoid a one-size-fits-all so we can meet the unique needs of urban schools?
I think so. Last session, I wasn't part of this, the rural task force, but the last session, the rural task force explored the needs that they had in the rural setting, and they came up with recommendations that eventually became a legislation this year. So, we need to look at what's working and not working in the urban setting, and those can be different than what's going on in the rural schools. So, that is what we are trying to do. I'm telling all the committee members that, you know, this is an opportunity for all of us to learn more about the urban schools. Many of us don't come from districts that have urban schools, and so this is a great opportunity for them to see the issues that these schools face and ask questions on and find ways that we could we can help.
Talking to Representative Jesse Rodriguez about a new task force on urban education in Wisconsin. Representative mm-hmm. Rodriguez, after this task force was announced, some critics said, hey, we see some people on here who have supported voucher schools, privatization options. Republicans have supported those things in the past. They're worried that the folks will be on more vouchers, more privatization at the expense of public schools. Is that part of the discussion here? How do you respond to those concerns?
No, that is not part of the discussion. I believe that there have been pieces written on, you know, the members that are pro-choice and pro-charter schools, but that is not the focus here. And I know that many people have asked me, you know, why I, you know, would want to do this. And a lot of people ask me where I stand with public education. I always tell them I'm not anti-public education. And my goal, or what I see working in the community that I did in the past, was that parents, you know, want options. And so it's an opportunity for them, if they have it, to get options. Now, this is not the focus of this committee at all. But I know that it is something that has been a concern for some people. But no, this is not the focus on them.
Now, this is a bipartisan task force, members of both parties. Do you think you're going to find room for agreement here, given that there's a lot of partisan divide about education and other issues in the state?
I hope so. I honestly don't know what the outcome will be, but I've been working with all my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, and I welcome their feedback. I'm asking, been asked, talking to them, and asking if they have any suggestions on speakers to let me know. So I hope that this is an opportunity for all of us to work together, you know, as a body, as a committee, but also work with the districts and work with other people who are in the districts, organizations who are dedicated to education, and really focus on one thing, and that is to find solutions to help improve outcomes for urban schools. We really need to really look at that, because these are, you know, the future, and these are, you know, our future workforce. And so, you know, looking at ways that we can help them, either to, you know, help them graduate from school and, you know, move on to the workforce if that's what they like, or helping them move on to the higher education. You know, that should be our ultimate focus, and that is what I want to kind of steer everyone in our committee to do, is ways that we can improve these outcomes so we can have successful children in the future.
There's been a lot of attention on racial achievement gaps here in Wisconsin, one of the worst in the nation as a state. Some local areas, Dane County, Milwaukee County, a serious problem there. Is that going to be one of the issues on the table?
I think that it is not one of the issues that we will be addressing, but it will be obviously the issue that will come up, just because a lot of these communities are the urban schools, you know, are working with minorities, and it's a higher population. So I think it will come up because that is the community that these school districts are working with, but. You know, that's up for us to look and see how we can go, look beyond that and, really look to find some solutions that would help.
Representative Rodriguez, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Rob.
That was Assembly Representative Jessie Rodriguez of Franklin. She was with us to talk about her role as the chair of the Speaker's Task Force on Urban Education. The committee hopes to have recommendations for the whole legislature by February or March of next year. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. For the last few months now, at least 17 Republicans and 5 Democrats have been crisscrossing the country, each one making the case that they should be the one to represent their party in the 2016 presidential election. There's plenty more campaigning to come, with the Iowa caucuses still 5 months away.
There's one big problem, says our next guest. The system we use to pick our presidential candidates is broken. He says our system of primaries and caucus convention contests and the lead up to them is no guarantee that the public will end up with the best or the most qualified candidates. He's got some ideas to shake things up.
Joining us now is Jack Johannes. He's a professor of political science at Villanova University and a former professor at Marquette University. He recently explored this issue in an opinion piece for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His new book is called Thinking About Political Reform, How to Fix or Not Fix American Government and Politics. Jack, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
So we're well into the campaign season, and yet there's still an awful lot of campaign to come. You sound at this point pretty early in that you're frustrated. Is that fair to say?
At the very least, yeah. The system is inefficient. I think it's ineffective. I don't think it enhances accountability, and it certainly doesn't do much to help us guarantee or at least have a good probability of electing good candidates.
And yet it has been this way for a long time. It's a part of American politics. Why should we uproot all this and try something new?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. One is the biggest reason, in my judgment, is that we don't have any kind of peer review. That is to say, the candidates are vetted by the electorate, or at least portions of the electorate, rather than by people who are really competent and involved in the process of governing. The cost of this system is outrageous. We're going to spend at least $1 billion on the nomination process this year. The time and energy it takes, the fact that people running for the presidency are divorced from people running from Congress at the same time, the system as it is allows, it almost inclines us towards a period of fascination with extremist candidates or candidates who are clearly out of the mainstream. Participation rates are very low. I mean, if we're interested in public participation, we don't get much, unlike what we would like. You've got closed primaries, which limit the selection process to a small number of partisans. It's all front-loaded. It's loaded up towards the front, which puts a tremendous advantage on funding and on media coverage. It gives a big, huge advantage to the early states. It enhances the role of the media, which not only tends to prescribe who should be winning and what the percentages they should get. The process has nothing to do at all with one's governing skills. So the bottom line is that we're getting a process which chooses candidates for us to vote in November, and the process really has nothing to do with the governing process.
Well, let's drill down to one of those that you mentioned there, and that is that the way primaries and caucuses are set up, it excludes a sizable group of likely voters. I think you say something like two-fifths of voters. How does that end up happening?
Well, there's two things that go on. First of all, a number of states, I think it's 11 states currently, that have rigorously closed primaries. There's another 30 states that have sort of closed, sort of open primaries or caucuses. So in a number of states, therefore, that the only people who can participate are those who identify with the party. Now, one can make a very good argument for that. But what that does is excludes a number of people from the possibility of participating in selecting the nominees. On the other side, you've got a front loaded process, which, except for 2008, which was an aberration, tends to reach a decision quickly by March or April as to who the party's nominees will be. And yet the primaries, the opportunity for people to participate extends, theoretically at least, into June. But those latter primaries and caucuses have no meaning because we already know by March who's going to get the nomination. So the participation rate in the nominating primaries nationally runs, you know, in the 20% range, 25% range. That's far from what is ideal.
And you also say because of who gets to be involved in these elections and caucuses that it skews toward people voting who are activists, and therefore the issues move either to the far left or the far right.
That is generally true. It's probably not quite as true as popular mythology would have it, but it is clear. I mean, if you look at Iowa, for example, the first caucus, or New Hampshire, the first primary, the people who participate in those caucuses and primaries are to the outside of the mainstream of their parties. Perhaps not radically outside, but outside enough. So those, and again, you know, in 12 of the last 14 presidential elections, if you don't win either Iowa or New Hampshire in the primary process, you're not going to be president of the United States. So what we're doing is we're loading up these early primaries with the authority, in effect, not to dictate, but certainly to influence who our eventual president is going to be. And those states, arguably, are not all that typical.
We're talking right now with political scientist Jack Johannes. He says the presidential nomination process in this country is in need of reform, and he's got some suggestions for us for making some meaningful changes. And Jack, one question for you. You've made the case that the process is cumbersome, that is, it's expensive, that it's exclusive to a certain extent. But does it work? Does it offer up candidates who do the job and can do the job well?
Well, I think each of us has to make that judgment on our own. But if you just look at the list of people who've been involved in this process, and perhaps that's one of the problems with the process, it tends to bring in marginal candidates. Michelle Bachmann, John Huntsman, Tim Pawlenty, Tommy Thompson of Wisconsin, of course. You got people like Elizabeth Dole, Dan Quayle, Douglas Wilder, Paul Tsongas. Most of these names none of us would recognize. Dennis Kuczynski, Carol Moseley Brown. These are all people who've been in the presidential, either the primary system, the season, or what we call the invisible primary, which is the year before the primary. There's a lot of unknowns and unqualified people, unqualified meaning they don't have the requisite experience, who are in this process and who sort of muck it up. And yet they oftentimes can appeal to people on emotional grounds. I mean, if you look at Donald Trump today, or Ben Carson, or Carly Fiorina, probably nice people, but they have absolutely zero governing experience. Now, how many of us would go to a dentist who has never filled a tooth, or go to an accountant who's never filled out a tax form? So this process encourages that kind of candidate. And with the current funding system we have, with the super PACs and so on, those kind of candidates not only can be funded, but they can stay in the process a much longer time than they used to be able to.
Well, let's
so
get
all
into
of that leads to, I think, a disastrous result.
I want to get into your proposed solutions now. You say that each party should establish a genuinely deliberative nominating convention, and it's going to have, of the composition, some of the party's most important stakeholders, including maybe former presidents, people from Congress that they'd actually be working with. Tell us more about your idea.
All right. It's a question of what we value in the process. If we value participation, then obviously a primary, massive national primary or something like that would be the way to go. If, on the other hand, we want a process that chooses candidates who are most likely to be able to govern, and who in the process of selection have established linkages to the people with whom they have to govern, then we should look for something radically different. And my proposal is to go back to the way they did it in the 1780s. Let's get the members of a given party, let's say Democrats, in the House, the Senate, and the governor's mansions, maybe former Democratic presidents, maybe Democratic state party chairman. Let them pick the best Democrat to run in November for our approval, and the same thing on the Republican side. Now, that is going to it means we don't have that direct participation, but what we have is a peer review process which is calculated towards successful governance, and it would link members of Congress and the governors to this candidate. And I think in the long run, that would be a much better thing for the country, and it would probably give us better choices in November as well.
Now, aren't you concerned, though, about cutting out the people altogether, the electorate, the voiceless, the people who are the stakeholders in how the country's governed?
Well, yes, I am concerned. On the one hand, they would have the ultimate say in November, clearly. Secondly, you know, the more I study the history of American politics, the more I'm fascinated by the way it was done back then. So, you know, the framers built the Constitution not as a participatory democratic system, but as a republic, a limited or moderated participation. James Madison in Federalist 10, I think, has this wonderful statement that if the public passes its views and its wishes through appropriately chosen representatives, the likely result is going to be better for the public than if the public could have chosen the policies themselves. Now, one can argue that case, but the idea here is that there are some people in this country who are simply more competent to make those judgments about who's going to be a good president than are other people. And let's face it, most of the voters don't pay much attention. They don't really get interested into this thing until late in the game, maybe a couple of weeks or 3 weeks before they go to vote, or they participate in a caucus, and they're very susceptible. The public is, I think, very susceptible to emotional appeals. And you see that especially in the early parts of the primary process. We're seeing it now. We'll see it up through the first three or four primaries in next year. So it doesn't bother me that the public would be eliminated directly from the process. They would have the ultimate say, which is what the public should do, but they would have the ultimate say in choosing candidates who I think would be better candidates and better potential presidents.
We're talking with political scientist Jack Johannes. He says the presidential nomination process in the country needs reform, and he's offering up some suggestions for changing it.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think our current nomination system is working for the United States, or could it use some tweaks or an overhaul? If so, what would change look like to you? How do you see it being better for the country? What do you think of the idea our guest just laid out? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking right now with political scientist Jack Johannes from Villanova University. He says our presidential nomination process, the primaries, the caucuses, the system needs reform, he says. He's giving us some ideas on what a change could look like.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the way that we choose and nominate presidential candidates in this country? Do you think it's fair to voters? Does it usually offer up the best candidates? Do you think it's even possible to try to reform the process at this point? And what would it look like? Your vision. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And one question, Jack, is let's say that there was widespread interest in this. People were buying into it, wanting to make a change. How would you ever transition from the system we've got going now to one like you describe?
Well, first of all, I don't think there will be widespread support for it, but supposing there were. Remember, the nominating process is a function of the two national political parties. They can dictate however they want it. Now, they do get involved with state laws, state legislative decisions, when it comes to timing and nature of state primaries. But if the parties chose, they could simply say, no more primaries, no more state caucuses. We're going to do this the way I'm suggesting. That is easily doable technically. The parties control their own destiny. They don't need to have any constitutional amendment or legislation passed. So it would not be hard to do that way. The difficulty, of course, is that most people simply think this would be crazy, it's undemocratic, it's elitist, and so on. And, you know, of course, to some extent, that's true. It's just a question of what people value. Do you value mass participation in the process, or would we prefer some more, what I would think would be more effective and more highly qualified candidates who have passed the peer review of the people with whom they have to govern?
Now, I'm curious about one of the things that we've seen in this race so far, particularly I think it's happening because of the number of candidates on the GOP side of the field, and that is candidates portraying themselves as the best person to take on the front runner of the other party, in this case Hillary Clinton, instead of why they themselves and their policies would be best for the country. Would this plan take care of that kind of thing?
I don't know if it would solve that problem, because politics at the presidential level in November is always about if there is an incumbent, I would be better than the incumbent, or certainly be better than the opponent. It wouldn't do anything to that, but I think you would wind up getting candidates who are more moderate and who have track records that could be discussed in presidential debates and through the media and so on. Because you would be getting, we wouldn't be diverted by marginal candidates who we know are not going to be a nominee. I mean, if you go back to 2012, Michelle Bachmann or Newt Gingrich or Herman Cain, we know they weren't going to be nominated. But yet they took up so much of the time, so much of the attention, which then diverts us from what we would like to be focused on, are the leading candidates, so we can understand where they stand and what the issues are and what their track record is.
Now, you said earlier that another side effect you see of the nomination process, which you're not happy with, is that there is a built-in fascination with extreme candidates, and that the model that you're putting out there would give more moderate candidates. Well, isn't that fascination that we see part of the electoral process, a part of the will of the people? And if we're seeing it, it's because people are interested in it, and therefore it should have a voice and a presence in the process.
You're absolutely correct. This is what people are fascinated with. People tend in this stage of the process. It'll change in November next year, but at this stage of the process, people are thinking more with their emotions. They love to hear a candidate say things that they feel deep in their guts. All right. But on sober reflection, they'll probably understand that those policies are not going to work, or they're not going to happen, or they're not good for the country. So what we see through this whole process now is we are spending so much time and so much money and so much media attention on political statements which probably don't make a lot of sense. I mean, when Donald Trump, and I don't want to pick on him, when he says, I'm going to build a wall that Mexico's going to pay for, no one in his right mind thinks that's true, but we all feel good about it. When Hillary Clinton says, I'm going to make sure that students can go through college without massive debts, we all feel good about that. But the reality is, those are not going to happen. They're not options. So I would rather have a system where we dealt with candidates who were realistic, and who had to be realistic because they were the ones chosen by their peers, who could present more realistic options to us. We could then make a more intelligent choice in the November election than perhaps we have been making.
We're talking with Jack Johannes right now, professor of political science at Villanova University. We're talking about his ideas for reforming the presidential nomination process. And one concern, as we look at your ideas, Jack, to have a sort of a peer review process to nominate the best candidates instead of the Electoral College, one problem that could happen is that you get more entrenched politics. You get more of the same instead of getting those fresh voices in, and the same power trends continuing on for a long time, more political dynasties.
Well, on the one hand, there's something to be said for political stability, but the reality is, if you look at the turnover rates in the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House, and these are the people who would do the nominating, turnover rates over the last two decades or so have been pretty substantial. We're turning over 20-25% of the House and Senate at almost every election. So you're not getting a permanent dynasty of Congress people who would then choose their favorite presidential candidate. And even if they were, I would think, at least I would argue, that it's better to have them pick a president with whom they know they can work to get things done, rather than for the voters to nominate candidates for the November election who may or may not be able to work with these people, the congressmen, the senators, the governors.
We have a comment here from Tyler on Facebook who says, I'd be interested in discussing it. Getting money out of politics would be great if that's what he means, and abolishing the Electoral College, even though it does serve a purpose. But you have to be very careful when talking about this stuff. Keeping the powers balanced is tough work, I'd imagine.
It is. Well, first of all, the Electoral College has nothing to do with the nomination process. That's the way we actually count the votes that are cast in November. So that's a separate issue entirely. But the money is not trivial. What's happening, first of all, we are spending, I mean, you remember we spent $6 billion on the entire presidential election process, or the entire election process 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago. We're going to spend $1 billion on this nomination process, not the general election, just the nomination process. Where is that money coming from? And that raises all the questions that your Facebook person has raised. But with all the invention or the development of the super PACs, which the Supreme Court has sanctioned, it is a lot easier for very marginal candidates who appeal to relatively small groups of people who have a lot of money to stay in these nomination contests. So I think it is quite possible that the selection through the primaries and the caucuses, which will begin in January, will extend a lot longer than they have been extending. There'll be more candidates, and they're saying perhaps more unreasonable things, but being well funded. So I think we've got an intersection here of a new campaign finance system, which has developed over the last 4 or 5 years, that now intersects with the nominating process, and I would argue not to the benefit of the mm-hmm. country.
Jack, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Jack Johannes, professor of political science at Villanova University, talking about reforming the presidential nominating process.